This is the first of a short series of studies in the book of Ecclesiastes. Now we have before us a book that has suffered at the hands of both friend and foe alike. Here's a book that has been described as the complaint of a disappointed man. It's been described as the best that man can do apart from God. And yet, here is a book which we find in the scriptures, and those scriptures are testified to as being the inspired word of God. Somebody has said that if this book is inspired, how is it then that it can make us wise unto salvation? For it forms part of those scriptures of which Paul spoke, which can make us wise unto salvation. And yet when you begin to read through this book, it's a very melancholy affair. So how does it do this? Well, I think because it touches the very need of mankind. And you know, the first step to salvation is to recognize one's need. If a person has got no need, then it's unlikely that he will accept Christ as his Savior. So this book is going to show us the utter need of mankind. Perhaps it is that this book has been condemned because it doesn't fit in with man's theology. Well, we know a little of man's theology, that it's sometimes not very good and it doesn't fit in with the rest of Scripture. But when this book is seen in its right context, I believe that we can look upon it and say that we have here the inspired Word of God. There are certain corrections, I think, that every believer needs to make in his mind with respect to what is meant by the inspiration of God, by the inspiration behind the scriptures which claim to be his. And I think there's no better passage that will help us to understand what is meant by inspiration than Job chapter 42 and verse 7. Job 42 and verse 7. Now here are some words which were written right at the end of this experience that Job passed through. An experience where his friends came to him and tried to solve his problems by their own wisdom or by the wisdom of the world. And here is the summing up of the Lord upon the words of the friends of Job. Job 42, verse 7. And it was so that after the Lord had spoken these words unto Job, the Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite, My wrath is kindled against thee and against thy two friends. Now note this, for you have not spoken of me the thing that is right, as my servant Job hath. So this means then that within the book of Job, and recorded in the words of the friends, we have something which is described by the Lord as being that which is not right. And this should guard us against that great danger which so many Christians fall into, of opening the Bible anywhere and taking a verse of Scripture and saying that that applies to them and that that is what they ought to do. Well, these words that the friends of Job spoke and which form a great part of the book of Job, we're told by the Lord, were not right. So inspiration in this particular instance must be looked upon as being something different. The inspiration, surely, is insofar that these words have been recorded for us. In much the same way that when the fool said in his heart, there is no God, it wasn't God that inspired him to say that. But he inspired the psalmist to record that the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. Again, we read in the Old Testament of many actions of the Old Testament saints, which could hardly be commended as examples to ourselves. Now, God didn't inspire those Old Testament saints to act in that fashion, but he did inspire some man at some time to record that they acted in that fashion. Now that is one correction that we've got to make to what we mean by the inspiration of God. And we might begin to think, well, we can apply this theory to the book of Ecclesiastes. And perhaps the critics are right. Perhaps it is a book which represents the best that man can do apart from God. But I think that there is a phrase in this book which prevents us from taking this attitude. If you turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 12 and verse 10. Ecclesiastes 12 and verse 10. The Lord allowed this man to write these words. The preacher sought to find out acceptable words, and that which was written was upright, even words of truth. So what we have then in this book, in the plain language of the preacher himself, is words of truth. And the whole point of this book, it seems to me, is to work out this conclusion of verse 13 of chapter 12. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Whatever he's said up to now, this is the conclusion that he's come to. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. And surely that's the conclusion that we ourselves have come to. In our own particular dispensation, we might express it somewhat differently. But it's the same thing, basically. The whole duty of man to fear God and keep his commandments. So here is the conclusion that this man is going to come to. Now I say this man, who do I refer to when I say that? Well, the tradition of both Jew and the church alike, the professing church, is that Solomon was the author of this book. And I think that this can be substantiated from a number of references in the book itself. If you look at the very opening verses of Ecclesiastes, there are two verses which point to the authorship of Solomon. The very first verse, chapter 1, verse 1, the words of the preacher, we're told that he was the son of David, king in Jerusalem. You look at verse 12, I the preacher was king over Israel in Jerusalem. It seems to me that those words can refer to none other than Solomon the king. Now that, to ourselves here, is surely enough. But other people require more proof than this. So let's have a look at this man and let's see something about him in the book itself. And I think that we'll see that this must have been Solomon. If you look at chapter 2 of Ecclesiastes, let's read verses 4 to 10. Note the resources that this man had available. He says, I made me great works. I builded me houses. I planted me vineyards. I made me gardens and orchards, and I planted trees in them of all kinds of fruit. I made me pools of water to water therewith the wood that bringeth forth trees. I got me servants and maidens, and had servants born in my house. Also I had great possessions of great and small cattle, above all that were in Jerusalem before me. I gathered me also silver and gold. Verse 9, so I was great, and increased more than all that were before me in Jerusalem. Verse 10, and whatsoever mine eyes desired, I kept not from them. I withheld not my heart from any joy. Well now, here's a man of vast resources. Anything that he wanted, he could have. Anything that money could buy. This must have been a very rich man. And it looks very much as though it was Solomon. If you look at the end of verse 9, which I deliberately missed out, he says, also, my wisdom remained with me. Now, Solomon's wisdom, of course, was proverbial. Look at chapter 1 and verse 16. He's going to tell us what this wisdom was. I commune with mine own heart, saying, lo, I am come to great estate, and have gotten more wisdom than all they that have been before me in Jerusalem. Yea, my heart had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. This surely must be Solomon. Such riches, such wisdom. But let's add a bit more evidence here. Look at chapter 12 of Ecclesiastes. Verse 9. And moreover, because the preacher was wise, he still taught the people knowledge. Yea, he gave good heed, and sought out and set in order many proverbs. Now the book of Proverbs is attributed to Solomon. They may not have all have been written by him. Some may have been written for him. But it is the book of the Proverbs of Solomon. And when we look through Ecclesiastes itself, if you look at chapter 10 and verse 1, you'll see that occasionally it propounds a proverb here. Dead flies cause the ointment of the apothecary to send forth a stinking savour. So doth a little folly him that is in reputation for wisdom and honour. And chapter 7 and verse 1. A good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death than the day of one's birth. Well, these are proverbs, and here he is propounding them again. But there's one thing more than ever which makes me convinced that this is the work of Solomon, and that is the experience of this man with women. If you look at chapter 7 and verse 26, or look at verse 25, I applied mine heart to know and to search and to seek out wisdom and the reason of things, and to know the wickedness of folly, even of foolishness and madness. And I find more bitter than death the woman whose heart is snares and nets, and her hands as bands. Whoso pleaseth God shall escape from her, but the sinner shall be taken by her. Behold, this have I found, saith the preacher, counting one by one, or better, weighing one thing after another to find out the reason. Verse 28, which yet my soul seeketh. He was still looking, but I find not. One man among a thousand have I found, but a woman among all those have I not found. The bitter experience of this man with women. Now let's look back at Solomon's life. 1 Kings chapter 11. 1 Kings 11. Verse 1. But King Solomon loved many strange women, together with the daughter of Pharaoh, women of the Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Zidonians, and Hittites, of the nations concerning which the Lord said unto the children of Israel, ye shall not go into them, neither shall they come in unto you. For surely they will turn away your heart after their gods. Solomon clave unto these in love. And he had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines. And his wives turned away his heart. There's the bitter experience of this man. 1,000 women. And he tells us that among that 1,000, he never found one true woman. Now, I don't think that this is a cause for despondency amongst the ladies, you see, because he found one true man among 1,000, but among a sample of 1,000 women, he couldn't find one. So that means they're rare, you see, and therefore probably worth more. So let's not be despondent about this, but here is the experience of a man who had 1,000 women and never found one that was really suitable to him, never found a help meet for him. And this is all the more tragic in the light of the advice that was given to him in the book of Proverbs. Look at Proverbs chapter 18. Verse 22. Whoso findeth a wife, findeth a good thing, and obtaineth favour of the Lord. Chapter 19, verse 14. House and riches are the inheritance of fathers, and a prudent wife is from the Lord. He looked upon it as a gift here. And then the way the book of Proverbs ends, chapter 31 and verse 10. And here's something of the value of a virtuous woman. Who can find a virtuous woman? Well, Solomon couldn't. He was looking in the wrong place. Who can find a virtuous woman? For her price is far above rubies. And then in those next verses, he goes on to show something of the nature of this virtuous woman. The heart of her husband doth safely trust in her. so that he shall have no need of spoil. She will do him good and not evil all the days of her life. She seeketh wool and flax, and worketh willingly with her hands, and so on. It goes on to show the wonderful way that behind every good man there is a good woman. And so, Solomon is indicated here in the book of Ecclesiastes because he couldn't find one in 1,000. But then look at the women that he went to, those that the Lord had told him not to, the women of the foreigners. Even in the book of Ecclesiastes, if you turn back there to chapter 9, Solomon knew this all the time. And look at his conclusion here. Ecclesiastes 9, verse 9. He says, live joyfully with the wife whom thou lovest all the days of the life of thy vanity. There it is. There's his conclusion right at the end. And yet he had not found such a thing in his own experience. Well, I think taking all this evidence together, one is forced to the conclusion that unless a man has forged this, and if he's forged this, he may have forged the rest of Scripture, and if that's true, he might as well pack up and go home. But unless that is true, this is the work of none other than Solomon the king. Now the next question to ask is, when in his experience did he write this? And I think this will already have become obvious. He wrote it in his old age. For this is the work of a man who can look back upon a life that has been filled with pleasure and yet without any satisfaction, without any profit, without anything remaining over for his old age. All is vanity and vexation of spirit. And he looks back upon this life and he sees it as a terrible, weary thing. Look at chapter 1 and verse 2. Here's his conclusion. Vanity of vanities, saith the preacher. Vanity of vanities. All is vanity. What profit of a man of all his labour, which he taketh under the sun? Then he goes on to show the endless wearying cycle of things. A man can do nothing to stop it. One generation passeth away, and another generation cometh. But the earth abideth forever. The sun also ariseth, the sun goeth down, and hasteth to his place where he arose, an endless cycle. The wind goeth toward the south, and turneth about unto the north. It whirleth about continually, and the wind returneth again according to his circuits. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. Unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again. Now I don't know whether Solomon knew of the processes of condensation and precipitation, but here it is. Perhaps not in the same scientific language, but he knew something about it. And then verse 8, all things are full of labour or weariness. Man cannot utter it. Here's a man who's looked back upon a life in which he's not influenced anything to do with God. And here he is. He sees it as a tremendous weariness. And you can feel this weariness in verse 5. The sun rises, the sun goes down. The sun rises, the sun goes down. The sun rises, the sun goes down. There's a weariness about the whole thing. Well, here he is, this man, speaking in this way. And so we see that the book of Ecclesiastes was written, as it were, like a piece of music, but written in a minor key. Vanity is written right across all the labour of mankind. And yet, this is remarkable, because the reign of Solomon was a reign of peace. It was a reign of rest, a reign of prosperity. There's never been a time like it before in the history of the people of Israel. And across that reign, which was almost the millennium itself, could be written these words, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Written right across it was the word Ichabod. Where is the glory? Well, there was no glory. Because you see, Solomon's glory existed in what he had done. Look at chapter 2 of this book. Verse 4. Notice the things that I did. I made me great works. I builded me houses. I planted me vineyards. I made me gardens, verse 6. I made me pools of water, verse 7. I got me servants, verse 8. I gathered me silver, verse 9. So I was great and increased. It's no wonder that we read of the glory of Solomon, the glory of Solomon, but it was the things that he had gotten to himself. And you remember what the Lord said when he compared the wisdom of Solomon with the lilies of the field. Let's just look at that. Matthew 6 and verses 27 to 29. Matthew 6. Which of you, by taking thought, can add one cubit to his stature? And why take ye thought for raiment? Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. And here it is. They toil not, neither do they spin. And this is what we're going to read in the letter, in the book of Ecclesiastes. The toil and the weariness of it all. And it ends up in vanity. But these lilies, they toil not, neither do they spin. And yet I say unto you that even Solomon, in all his glory, was not arrayed like one of these. What a comparison between the works of God and the works of Solomon here. So when Solomon then, looking back upon this life, which has largely been a failure, which has turned back from God and has occupied itself with worshipping idols, Solomon looks back and he writes these words. But I rather feel, you know, that he's cast this piece of music, as it were, in a minor key, in order that the final chord may appear the more brilliant. For his conclusion is to fear God and to keep his commandments. And you know, that is something that he knew right at the beginning of his life. And it's the beginning of wisdom, to the fear of the Lord. Proverbs 9 and verse 10. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. So he starts off, the beginning of wisdom is the fear of the Lord. And when Solomon has exercised all his wisdom and looked back on the whole of his life, he comes to the same conclusion, fear God and keep his commandments. Now I think it will help us in understanding this book to see what was in the mind of Solomon when he wrote certain parts of it. We must remember that to Solomon fell that wonderful privilege of building the house of the Lord, of building the temple at Jerusalem. And you know, it's recorded that at the dedication of that temple, there were many sacrifices offered. In fact, the actual words are that they could not be numbered for multitude. They never bothered to keep a note of how many. They could not be numbered for multitude. Well, looking back upon that experience, we can perhaps understand what he meant when in Ecclesiastes chapter 5, he wrote this. Ecclesiastes 5 and verse 1. Keep thy foot when thou goest to the house of God, the temple, of course, he would have in mind, and be more ready to hear, be more ready to obey than to give the sacrifice of faults. He knew the words of the psalmist, that it is better to obey than to sacrifice. And all those sacrifices that had been offered at the dedication of the temple, and which we have good reason to believe continue to be offered, sacrifice after sacrifice, thousands, millions of animals that were offered. And yet he can look back and see the sacrifice of fools. Far better were it for him to have obeyed than to this sacrifice. Then also we can see that Solomon is concerned here about what's going to happen after his death. And the kind of boy that he has raised up, this man called Rehoboam, who was to take over the throne from him. Look at chapter 2 of Ecclesiastes. Verse 18. He says, yea, I hated all my labour, which I had taken under the sun. Why did he hate it? Because I should leave it unto the man that shall be after me. And who knoweth whether he shall be a wise man or a fool? Yet shall he have rule over all my labour wherein I have laboured, and wherein I have showed myself wise under the sun. This is also vanity. Therefore I went about to cause my heart to despair of all the labour which I took under the sun. I rather feel that Solomon knew the nature of this man Rehoboam. He knew the nature of his son. He must have already felt it. And you know, one of the most terrible things about this is that Rehoboam followed in his father's footsteps. He had his father's bad example before him, and he followed along exactly the same lines. Second Chronicles will give us a picture of the man who was to take over the throne from Solomon. 2 Chronicles chapter 11. Verse 21. And Rehoboam loved Maachah, the daughter of Absalom, above all his wives and concubines. For he took 18 wives and 80 concubines, following, you see, in his father's footsteps. Chapter 12 and verse 1. And it came to pass, when Rehoboam had established the kingdom and had strengthened himself, he forsook the law of the Lord, and all Israel with him. Verse 13. So King Rehoboam strengthened himself in Jerusalem and reigned. Verse 14. And he did evil, because he prepared, or he fixed not his heart, to seek the Lord. Well, perhaps Solomon had himself to blame for the example that he set this young man, Rehoboam. And perhaps this is the reason that he wrote those words. Remember now thy Creator in the days of thy youth, before these evil days which now had come upon Solomon as he sat there in his couch, surrounded by every luxury, those evil days that were now come upon him. Remember, Rehoboam, thy Creator in the days of thy youth. But then Solomon, when he wrote this work, I feel also knew something else. He had been told that after his death, the kingdom was going to be rent from the house of David. David was going to be given one tribe, but 10 tribes were going to depart, going to be divided, and were going to be under another king. So Solomon had this in his mind when he began to write this. And I think this is maybe one of the reasons, at least, why he chose not to call himself Solomon here. He calls himself the preacher. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. And the word in the Hebrew is koheleth. It comes from the verb kahor, meaning to gather. To gather. His kingdom was going to be rent from him and divided. And Solomon calls himself the one who gathers. I wonder if he had in mind this when he wrote those words. Also, the very name of this book, Ecclesiastes. It comes from the Greek word ecclesia, church, a gathering together of people. So here it is then. Israel were going to be scattered, and Solomon was the one who could have held them together. Strictly speaking, it was only under the reign of Solomon that Israel were ever united. Do you remember the days of David, how they were filled with war? If David wasn't running away from Saul, he was at war with some other nation. Solomon's reign came. It was a reign of peace. It was practically the millennium, but of course not quite, for Christ was not there. But written right across it, no prophet. It was a divided kingdom after him, and he was the gatherer, the one that could have held it together. Solomon's viewpoint when he wrote this. Let's think what that was. The book of Ecclesiastes has been criticized because there's no hope of resurrection in the book. Nowhere in this book is there a hope of resurrection, so we're told. But then you see, the people that say that have ignored the viewpoint of Solomon here. 29 times the expression comes in this book, under the sun. Under the sun. It comes time and time again. Chapter 1 and verse 3, he asks the question, what prophet hath a man of all his labour which he taketh under the sun? And he answers that question in chapter 2 and verse 11. Then I looked on all the works that my hands had wrought, and on the labour that I had laboured to do, and behold, all was vanity and vexation of spirit, and there was no profit under the sun. We must limit the book by that expression. That's what Solomon's got in his mind. when he wrote it. And the word prophet means literally a remainder. There's nothing remaining over after that you've gone through these experiences. If you look at verse 10 of chapter 2, you'll see the only prophet there is. Well, it's not prophet, it's a reward. And whatsoever mine eyes desired, I kept not from them. I withheld not my heart from any joy, for my heart rejoiced in all my labour, and this was my portion of all my labour. There was nothing over, there was just the pleasure, the enjoyment of the moment. That was all there was. There was nothing that remained over and above it. He had so much pleasure. When that was finished, flat. No profit to all my labour under the sun. I rather feel that this book is a commentary on those words which were spoken first to Adam, that in the sweat of his brow he would bring forth his living from the ground. And he would do it until he returned to the dust as he was. Well, they are the words of Solomon here. He talks about the dust returning to the dust as it was, and the spirit returning to God who gave it. But we mustn't end on this dreary note, because this book is also an echo of something that was going to be written later on by the Apostle Paul. Would you turn to Romans chapter 8? Romans 8, verse 19. For the earnest expectation of the creation waiteth for the manifestation of the sons of God. For the creature was made subject to vanity. Well, this is Ecclesiastes. All is vanity. The creation was made subject to vanity, not willingly, and here it comes, but by reason of him who has subjected the same in hope. Now we begin to get it. Ecclesiastes, all is vanity, but there's a hope. And that hope can only come out when we realize the context of resurrection. Because the creation itself also shall be delivered from the bondage of corruption into the liberty of the glory of the children of God. The experience of Solomon was all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. He could only make a glory for himself. And that glory was nothing like the glory of the lilies of the field, the work of God. This is as far as he could go. But the whole creation is going to be delivered. And it looks for the liberty of the glory of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation groaneth and travaileth in pain together until now. And so Solomon had that experience. The great hope was in resurrection. And when Paul later wrote that wonderful passage, 1 Corinthians 15, on the resurrection, this is what he said. Verse 58, therefore, my beloved brethren, be ye steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, for as much as you know that your labour is not in vain in the Lord. But how important those last words are, your labour not in vain in the Lord. Now it's been said, as I've suggested, that there's no hope of resurrection in Ecclesiastes. And certainly in the sense in which resurrection appears in the book of Job, there isn't. But look back at Ecclesiastes chapter 12, and see the very last word of this man. Ecclesiastes 12 and verse 14. Now when the Jews read these two verses, verses 13 and 14, they used to switch them round because they like to end on a good note, you see. So they used to read verse 13 last. But strictly verse 14 is the last verse. For God shall bring every work into judgment, with every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil. Now, how's God going to do this? How is he going to bring every work into judgment? Well, surely this implies resurrection, being raised in order to be judged. So here it is then. There is a suggestion behind the book of a resurrection. It may not be much of a suggestion, but it's there. But we mustn't forget the object in writing this. It was to show those things which are under the sun and to show that all is vanity and vexation of spirit. We must also remember, in looking at this book, that Solomon never knew anything about spiritual blessings in heavenly places. That has not been written yet. There are some people who seem to want to read into this some of the wonderful New Testament truths. We mustn't do that. This man had an earthly hope. His eyes were fixed down here on this earth. He looked for earthly blessings, and hence we can understand some of his words. Look at chapter 2 of Ecclesiastes. And verse 24. Here are some of the conclusions that he came to. There is nothing better for a man than that he should eat and drink, and that he should make his soul enjoy good in his labour. This also I saw, that it was from the hand of God. Well, the people with earthly blessings, what are they enjoined to do? To enjoy the earthly blessing. Chapter 3, verse 12. I know that there is no good in them, but for a man to rejoice and to do good in his life, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labour. It is the gift of God. Well, that couldn't be plain. Verse 22. Wherefore I perceive that there is nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his own works, for that is his portion. Again it's plain. Chapter 5, verse 18. Behold that which I have seen. It is good and comely for one to eat and to drink and to enjoy the good of all his labour that he taketh under the sun all the days of his life which God giveth him, for it is his portion. And chapter 8 and verse 15. Then I commended mirth, because a man hath no better thing under the sun than to eat and to drink and to be merry, for that shall abide with him of his labour, the days of his life, which God giveth him under the sun. Well, all this must be seen in the light of a man who had been given an earthly inheritance and was expecting from the Lord earthly blessings. Blessings, as the Lord tells us, of basket and of store. And what should a man? Should he despise such blessings? No. Solomon says he should enter into them, enjoy them, as far as he possibly could. I think the great thought behind this book of Ecclesiastes is the thought that there is a work of God going on. That work of God is partly known and partly unknown. Look at chapter 8 and verse 17. Then I beheld all the work of God, that a man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun. Because though a man labour to seek it out, yet he shall not find it. Yea, farther, though a wise man think to know it, yet shall he not be able to find it. God has revealed so much. There's so much knowledge. And that they are to walk in the light of it. Something is known, it's partly known. And the attitude should be in keeping with this. In the light of that which is known, a man should fear God and keep his commandments. That's Solomon's verdict here. In other words, his work should, as far as is possible, fit in with God's season. And you remember chapter 3, to everything, there is a season and a time to every purpose under heaven. God is working out everything according to season. And it's the duty of man, according to how he has understood that, to fit in with it. This is saying simply, keeping the line of the will of God. And what about those things that he can't see? Those things which have not been revealed to him? Well, he mustn't worry about them. He must trust where he cannot see. And a man who is truly trusting will be cheerful and he will be contented. And that is what Solomon is saying here concerning all those things which are done under the sun, that a man should be contented in them. Well, we could go further into this wonderful book. We could look at some of the conclusions that he comes to. Let me just read out those that I've so far discovered. He comes to the conclusion that God is sovereign, that calamity as well as blessing comes from the hand of God, that wisdom and knowledge increase sorrow. Just have a brief look at that. Chapter 1 and verse 18. Here's something that we ought to think on. In much wisdom is much grief, and he that increaseth knowledge increaseth sorrow. I think we all know something of this. Take the little child. It's happy. There's not a thing that worries its mind. But as it begins to grow and as it begins to see some of the things that go on in this world and realize what the world is about, the increase of knowledge brings with it an increase of sorrow. But there's a wonderful thing about this sorrow, and that is that it's beneficial. Chapter 7 and verse 3. Sorrow is better than laughter. Well, we wouldn't have thought so, but he tells us it is. Why is this? For by the sadness of the countenance, the heart is made better. I think most of us must have had the experience of meeting a certain man who seemed not to fit in to society. He seemed to be no good. And then he was called to pass through a terrible period, a period whereby he lost a loved one or something happened to him. And he came through that, and it, as it were, it refined him. And it made a man of him. Now, we must all, surely, at some time have met a man who's gone through that experience. We may have gone through the experience ourselves. But here it is. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by the sadness of the countenance, the heart is made better. And then Solomon also discovered that there was no respect of persons with God, for the sinner and the righteous man died alike. We've already seen that he had a certainty of a future judgment, that God's ways were past finding out. And he says in the light of all this, let us hear the conclusion of the matter. It's this, fear God and keep his commandments. This is the whole duty of man. Now, when we meet together next time, we'll perhaps be in a position to start going through this wonderful book and seeing what lessons there are in it for ourselves.